Tuned to Radio Free Asgard, episode number 90. The Theft of Idun's Apples. Very early one summer morning, Odin, Loki, and Hoenir crossed into Midgard, happy in one another's company, and intent upon exploring some part of the earth not already known to them. In the pale blue, almost pale green light that gives an edge to everything, the three friends crossed a desolate reach of grit, patrolled only by the winds. Before men in Midgard had stirred and woken, the gods were striding over scrubby, undulating ground. Then they tramped around a great mass of spiky, dead, dark rock and headed for the summit of a conical mountain. All day they trekked and talked, and in the evening they followed the course of a rapid milky river from a glacier down into a valley, a jigsaw of fields, yellow and brown and green. Odin, Loki, and Hoenir had not brought any food with them, and were beginning to feel very uneasy about it when they had the luck to come upon a herd of oxen. While Loki sized them up, chose one, and killed it, Odin and Hoenir gathered fallen branches from a grove of stunted oaks and made a fire. Then they cut up the ox into huge pieces and put the pieces into the heart of the fire. The smell ravished the gods. They could hardly wait to eat. As soon as they thought the joints were roasted, they scattered the fire and pulled the meat out of the flames.
"It's not ready," said Odin, surprised. "We must be so hungry that a little time seemed long to us."
Loki and Hoenir raked up the brands and put the meat back into the fire again. Suddenly, a chill wind channeled down the valley. Although the sun still loped across the western sky with the wolf at its heels, all the heat had drained out of the summer day. The three gods wrapped their cloaks around them and sat and waited.
"Do you think it's ready?" asked Hoenir.
"What do you think? Shall I find out?"
"One of these days you'll choke on your own uncertainty," Loki said, leaping to his feet and scattering the fire for a second time. "It must be cooked by now."
Odin took a piece out of the flames.
"It's still not ready," he said, "and it ought to be."
"There's nothing wrong with this fire," Hoenir said. "And yet our dinner is as raw now as it was to begin with," said Loki, looking at the meat and grimacing.
"Well," said Odin, "something is working against it."
"Something sitting up here," said a voice from above them.
The three gods at once looked up into the leafy branches of the oak tree above the fire. They looked and they saw an eagle sitting there, and it wasn't a small one.
"Let me eat my fill," said the eagle to the three upturned faces, "and your ox shall be cooked."
The gods conferred and were of one mind.
"Since we too want to eat tonight," Odin told the eagle, "we agree. There is nothing else we can do."
Then the eagle screeched. It flapped its immense wings, swooped down from the tree, and settled over the fire. At once it snatched up both of the shoulders and both parts of the rump as well. Then it eyed the gods, and crouching at the root of the oak, began to eat. Loki was so angry that he raised his staff and rammed it into the bird's body. The eagle was thrown off balance and dropped the meat. It screeched again and took to the air. One end of the staff was firmly lodged in the eagle's back, and to his alarm, Loki found that he was unable to let go of the other. He pulled and twisted and yelled to no purpose. His hands were stuck to the staff. The eagle flew at great speed, and it took care to fly close enough to the ground to make sure that Loki did not have a smooth ride. The trickster was dragged across the floor of Midgard. His knees and ankles banged into boulders. His legs and feet were scratched by gorse bushes and thorns until they were bleeding.
"Mercy!" shouted Loki.
The eagle took no notice. It dragged Loki on his backside across a glacier until he was all but skinned.
"Mercy!"
yelled Loki again. He thought his outstretched arms were going to be wrenched from their sockets.
"Only," said the eagle, rising to give Loki a little respite, "only if you will swear..."
"What?" shouted Loki.
"Anything, mercy!"
"Only if you swear to bring Eden and her apples out of Asgard."
Loki closed his eyes and pressed his lips together and said nothing. He knew now that the eagle could only be one of the giants in disguise. The eagle swooped again, and Loki could hardly bear the pain as his kneecaps and shins and ankles and toes cracked against rocks and boulders and scree.
"Mercy," implored Loki. "I promise you, I swear it."
7 days hence," said the eagle.
"Lead Eden over Bifrost when the sun is halfway between east and west." "I promise," called Loki.
The trickster found that his hands were at once set free, and he fell to the stony ground. Very slowly, he picked himself up and looked at his wounds. Then, in the gathering darkness, he began to limp back toward his companions. 7 days passed, and Loki found Idun wandering through the sloping field above her hall. She was singing softly to herself, and was quite carefree. The sun caressed her. Childlike she moved, untroubled by the world's troubles around her. Petty squabbles, suffering, savage wars, and always time passing. Her basket of golden apples was looped over one arm.
"Eden!" called Loki.
Bragi's wife paused and turned.
"I've come at once. You can't imagine. I could scarcely believe it myself."
"Speak more simply," said Eden.
"Deep in the forest, just beyond Bifrost, I came across a tree quite unlike the others. Unlike any tree I've seen in the Nine Worlds. It stands in a glade and it glows with a soft light."
Eden opened her gray eyes wide, and Loki went on to describe his find so carefully that anyone less trusting would have known it came straight out of his head.
"Eden. It bears golden apples," he said,
jabbing with his forefingers at one of the apples in the basket.
"The same as yours. And perhaps like yours, they contain unending youth. We should take them at once for the gods."
Eden smiled and nodded in agreement.
"Don't forget your own apples. We must compare them," said Loki.
And he led the way over the sunlit field and out of Asgard. They hurried past Heimdall's hall, and then Loki took Eden by the hand and walked with her over Bifrost. The flames danced around their feet and they were unharmed. The eagle was waiting. As soon as Eden set foot in Midgard, it rose from a thicket. It beat its dark wings, swooped on the goddess and snatched her up. It carried her and her apple straight over the sea to Jotunheim. For as Loki had suspected, the eagle was none other than a giant. It was Thiazi. Thiazi lifted Eden to his storm home at Thrymheim, high in the mountains. "Here you'll stay," he gloated. "Without you, without your apples, the gods will age, and I will remain young forever." When they missed Eden, the gods at once grew extremely anxious. They knew that without her magic apples, they would wither and grow old. And indeed, they soon began to crumple inside their clothes and to seem smaller than they were before. Their skin hung over their bone houses, bunched or puffy or wrinkled, or stretched so tight that it looked as though the bone would break through. The eyes of one became bloodshot, and the eyes of another misty. One god's hands began to tremble. One lost all of his hair, and one could not control his bowels. Their joints creaked and ached, and they felt utterly limb-weary. The gods felt the spring in their step and the strength in their bodies ebbing from them hour by hour. Then the minds of the gods lost their skip and began to soften. One became outspoken about the shortcomings of the others, and one began to ramble like an idiot. But most of the gods grew quiet and did not trouble to say many things they would have said before. And they were all obsessed by the same concern with time, the same fear. When they did speak, they repeated themselves, or they began sentences and did not complete them. The summer sunlight shone on Asgard. Flocculent clouds drifted overhead, and the minds of the gods wandered even as they worried about their old age. Odin knew he must rally his own strength and summon the gods to council. Everyone in Asgard made his way to Gladsheim, a dismal, straggling procession under the sun. Of all the gods and goddesses and their servants, only Idun and Loki were missing. Allfather looked at the great gathering of stooping, shuffling, mumbling figures. "We must find Idun," he called. "You see how it is without her, without her apples? And it will grow worse. Who was the last to see her?"
"I saw Loki lead Idun over Bifrost," said Heimdall's servant.
There was a deep silence in Gladsheim. No one doubted then that Loki was the cause of what had happened to them.
"There is only one thing to do," said Odin. "We must capture Loki."
Weary as they were, the gods searched for the trickster. They looked in every hall and outbuilding, and in every copse and corner of Asgard. They knew their lives depended on it. At last they found him asleep in Eden's own field, and they seized and bound him before he could do anything about it. Loki was brought to Valaskjalf, protesting, and there Odin at once charged him with leading Idun out of Asgard.
"Bring her back," said the Allfather. "Your choice is easy to explain and easy to understand. Bring Idun and her apples back, otherwise we'll put you to death."
"It is true," said Loki, "that I walked out of Asgard with Idun, but then I had no choice."
Loki told them how the eagle that had carried him off while he was trekking with Odin and Hoenir was none other than the giant Thiasi.
"And I had to agree to those threats to escape with my life," said Loki.
"Did you have to fulfill them?"
asked Odin. Loki's eyes gleamed, red and green.
"Since you consort with eagles," said Odin, "we'll draw Blood Eagle on your back."
"No,"
said Loki, and he shrank before Odin's savage eye,
"and your rib cage will spring apart."
"No,"
said Loki, cowering.
"Like wings,"
said Odin, and his teeth were clenched.
"I will find Idun and her apples," said Loki. "If Freya will lend me her falcon skin, I'll fly at once into Jotunheim, I swear it."
Then Odin shook and released Loki. And Freya, beautiful Freya, her face like a pouch now and her hair falling out, went directly to her hall with him. She pulled down the falcon skin, hanging over one of the beams.
"You're not quite so beautiful now that you're bald," said Loki.
Freya said nothing. Her body shook. She wept tears of gold and handed Loki the falcon skin. Thrymheim perched on the top of a precipitous skir and seemed actually to grow out of the dark rock. The winds whirled around it, and they found their way through the halls into the cold, drafty rooms. When Loki reached it in the early evening, he was fortunate enough to find the giant Thiasi was not at home. He had gone off fishing, and his daughter Skadi had gone with him. Loki discovered Idun in a smoky room huddled over a fire. She turned to him, and at once the schemer extended his falcon wings. He murmured the runes, the magic words, and turned Idun into a nut. Then he picked her up between his claws and flew off as fast as he could. In a little time, Thiasi and his daughter returned from the day's fishing. When the giant found that Idun was no longer there, he roared and hurled his pails to the ground. He knew there was no way in which the goddess could have escaped from Thrymheim without help. Then Thiasi donned his eagle skin for a third time and set off across the mountains in the high, lifeless wilderness. The distance from Thrymheim to Asgard was immense, and the eagle was stronger than the falcon. As Loki drew closer to Asgard, so Thiasi drew closer to Loki. When he sat in Hlidskjalf, looking over the nine worlds, nothing escaped Odin. No movement of man or giant or elf or dwarf, bird in the air or animal on earth or fish in the water. What other gods could not see at all, Allfather fixed and followed with his single eye. Now he saw Loki flying at great speed towards Asgard and the eagle Thiasi chasing him. At once he ordered all the gods and goddesses and their servants, worn out and short-winded as they were, to hurry out of Asgard with bundles of plane shavings, all the wood that the servants of the gods prepared to kindle fires in their great halls.
"Pile them up against the walls," said Odin. "Loki is coming."
The still summer air began to hum, as if an unseen storm were near and about to burst on them. It began to throb, and then the gods and goddesses saw the falcon and the huge eagle close behind it. From a great height, the falcon dived down over the walls of Asgard, still holding the nut between its claws.
"Light the shavings!" cried Odin. "The shavings!"
The flames leapt up, almost unseen in the bright sunlight. The eagle was so close behind the falcon that he could not stop himself. He flew straight through the flames, his wings caught fire. Thiazi blundered on into Asgard and fell to the ground in torment. Then the gods stumbled back through the gates into their citadel and quickly killed him there. Loki threw off Freya's falcon skin. He looked at the gray, aged, anxious ones pressing around him and scornfully laughed in their faces. Then the Sky Traveler bent over his trophy. He cradled it between his hands and softly spoke the runes. Idun stood there, young and supple and smiling. She moved innocent among the ailing gods. She offered them apples. So that was The Theft of Idun's Apples, as written by Kevin Crosley Holland in his book The Norse Myths. The music, of course, is from Edain, The Invincible Sword of the Elvesmith by Mats Wendt, and is used with permission. This is an interesting myth, and it's one of the more well-known Norse myths to the general public. What's really interesting about this is that it's really the only time we see Idun, the goddess, as a character, even though, according to Snorri Sturluson, she was one of the chief goddesses among the Norse gods. And it's really unfortunate that we're missing so many of these stories, and we really don't have a very clear picture of who she is and what her function was among the Norse gods. One of the things I find really intriguing about her is that she's spoken about as being innocent. And to us in the modern day, that seems to be kind of, I don't know, dingy or ditzy. In one sense, it's kind of hard to tell because in the story, she really only has one line. But at the same time, maybe this meant something completely different to the Norse. And I suppose without more manuscripts turning up or whatever, we're probably never going to know. We also really have another portrayal here of another goddess, Freya. And again, she's not portrayed in the most, I don't know, flattering light, you could say. Now, obviously, she's being made fun of by Loki for being bald, and it gets all emotional about it. Well, what would you expect? I mean, I don't know if this is going to be considered a normal behavior for Freya, or whether this is the effect of the aging. You really don't get a very clear idea about that. But as always, I find these myths to be absolutely fascinating. And in this particular case, every bit as intriguing as a modern story. Certainly, this holds up really well as a story. Certainly very mythic in scope. It's not something that you would perhaps put in a comic, but there's definitely a bit of suspense there. You have a nice build to the story, and then you have a very satisfying conclusion at the end. One of the interesting things, again, about the story is you have Loki as portrayed as not as the god of evil, the way he's portrayed in the Marvel comics, but really the equal of other gods. And he's, you know, good friends with Odin and Hoenir, and he goes out camping with them. It's not like they don't trust him at all, because in a lot of instances, he doesn't actively work against the gods. This is one of the few examples where he does. And of course, he does so out of his own self-interest. He's getting scraped all to hell by this eagle. He's going to promise anything. At the same time, when Odin challenges him, "Well, you didn't need to keep your word," it kind of gives us some insight into Loki's mischief-making does have this darker side that maybe, you know, he wants to wreak havoc, and that's his function. And that's what the people who are being told the story expect from Loki. They expect him to be a good villain. He's the god they love to hate. Anyway, so let's move along now. We do have an issue to cover this time, so let's go ahead and move along to our review.
Cross the rainbow bridge of Asgard, where the booming heavens roar. You'll behold in breathless wonder the god of thunder, mighty Thor.
So this week we behold with breathless wonder Thor number 378. Has a cover date of April of 1987, retail for 75 cents, as we continue on with these last few issues of the Walt Simonson run. Cover art is by Walt Simonson and shows Thor dressed fully in his new armor. Yeah, remember last issue he was making this suit of armor at this steel mill in Pittsburgh. And then, of course, the steel mill gets attacked. There's a big fight. He fights Grendel, blah, blah, blah. So he was making this armor. Now, I seem to recall last issue, this armor was nowhere near finished. So I kind of wonder what happens here. But anyway, yeah, we have a beautiful cover here by Simonson of Thor, and he's wearing his new armor. And unlike his last costume, he has a face mask. And this is based on old Viking helmets that have the sort of eyepiece around the eyes. And it actually looks pretty cool. Of the later Thor costumes, this is one that I do kind of like. Though I can imagine it was kind of a pain in the butt to draw. Because you have this look like band mail around the legs and the arms, and then you have the sort of scale mail on the chest piece, and these clasps holding Thor's cape to the armor. And it looks like it would just take a long time to draw, I guess, is my main criticism of it. Anyway, we open to the splash page. Stan Lee presents The Mighty Thor. And the title of the story is When Loki Stood Alone. And we have the credits. Walt Simonson was the writer. Sal Buscema on pencils and inks. John Workman Jr. was the letterer. Max Scheele was the colorist. Ralph Macchio was the editor. And Jim Shooter was the editor-in-chief. And we pick up right where we left off last issue with Loki in his castle. And the doors are being battered in by the frost giants. And they are big. Yeah, they've grown since last time we saw them when they were shorter than Loki. And the cold that Loki is generating through his secret laboratory. And he's got Iceman from X-Factor, if you remember, kind of strapped into the Stargate thing. And that's shooting all this cold air into Jotunheim and growing the giants. And they're smashing through the doors and saying, "Death to all Asgardians! The crown must be ours! Death to Loki!" And they're breaking through the door with a crash! And Loki's standing there looking flabbergasted. And he gets angry. He's like, "Ungrateful wretches! Is this how the gifts of Loki are repaid?" And he shoots these magical bolts out of his hands with a zyow, zyow. And they hit the giants, and they fall back with a gah. But that's not really enough to stop them. And they keep kind of lunging forward. It's like, "Coo him! Take the cold!" And Loki takes off running. He's running towards his laboratory. He's like, "Incredible. They are rampaging with the total fury of berserkers. Somehow the cold I generated to restore them to their original height affected not only their bodies, but has driven them mad as well. Evidently my plan to assist the frost giants of Jotunheim have gone amiss. I need a moment to gather my wits, and the great door, reinforced by a spell of binding, shall hold them for now." And he casts a spell on the door with a fizasped. And Thor is laying there. Remember, he transported Thor here to keep him from getting pulverized by Grendel last issue. And Thor is laying there with his hammer by his side. And Thor is laying there. We get a little bit of a background here. Get a kind of one panel flashback of what happened last issue. Blah, blah, blah. Don't really need to know. And we get a little bit of exposition about basically what Thor's situation is. And Thor is unconscious because of his fight with Grendel. And Loki explains Hela's curse to us again out loud because, you know, there's obviously an audience for him to talk to. And he decides to transport Thor, who was sitting here unconscious, out into the main hall where the giants can play with him to kind of buy Loki time. So he transports him there with a thrap. And the giants are like, "Huh? It's Thor Odinson, the Thunderer, slayer of giants and their kin, without his terrible hammer." And Loki's like, "A present, Grendroth, for you and your friends. He swore to begin the complete destruction of all the frost giants when he awoke." Loki goes running off as they are distracted by Thor and runs off to his laboratory.
Now all those lackwits waste their time futilely trying to slay the Thunder God, I shall return to my laboratory and prepare magics that will, by the well of weird, and he's astounded, sees Iceman is completely frozen solid, all of his machinery, and it's so cold in the room that he can barely even stay in there. So he's like, the machineries I use to extract the total power of the Iceman have been frozen solid, and more ice is forming every moment. Robert Drake seeks to overload the cold enhancers that hold him captive. No wonder the giants have been driven half mad by desire. Mortals, cease this effort at once, do you hear? You will destroy the labor of years. And Iceman's like, I can't hear you. I've got ice in my ears. And Loki's like, stop it, you fool. And he shoots a magical bolt at him. Basically destroys the Stargate thing that Iceman is stuck to. Because the cold he's generating is drawing the giants there like a beacon. And Iceman's like, it's too late. I'm going to give it everything I got. And he's just emitting as much cold as he possibly can with a scream. And the giants, meanwhile, have been distracted by Thor, and they picked him up, and they're carrying him around like a doll. It's like, wake him up, then kill him! No, crush the cursed son of Odin, now! And the giants hear something behind them, and they realize that the cold is filling the entire castle, and the giants are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's like, we grow again! More! I must have more! There was never such a bone-chilling winter as this. It's coming from the castle depths! Forget Thor! The cold is ours for the taking! And they go smashing into the laboratory of Loki. And when we possess its source, we will be the masters of all who live! Follow me, giants of storm and fury! This is the way! The entire hallway is frozen solid. And they are met by Loki, who says, take one step further at your peril, Grundroth. This is the house of Loki, and he bids you halt. I said, stand where you are. I have taken your measure now, and the consequences of disobedience will be fatal. And he starts shooting fireballs at the ice giants, or the frost giants, whatever they are. I'm not quite sure what kind of giants these are. But he's shooting fireballs at them, and they're kind of dodging them, and there's all this heat now. And it starts to melt some of them, which is interesting, because I don't think they're actually made of ice. And they're not made of plastic or anything either. But anyway, this heat is actually melting the giants into goo, unlike the Shrinky Dinks, which just kind of shrunk them smaller, like we saw in Baldur the Brave miniseries. These are actually melting into puddles, like ice. Or maybe more like the cars that Loki had changed into ice cream back in the Journey into Mystery days. And other giants are like, the hallway! Smash the sides of the hallway! Hurry before we perish! And the flying debris destroys Loki's fireball, and they're keeping Loki off balance by hammering at him with their axes and stuff. And Loki realizes that he needs to escape or all is lost. And the giants have been now distracted by Loki, and Thor starts to regain consciousness. And his hand and his leg are hurting a lot. Remember, he got broken with the battle with Grendel. And he's not really sure where he is, but he knows that they're frost giants here, and he recognizes now that he's in Loki's castle. He realizes that Loki is in a pitched battle against the giants, and he sees that the giants they've captured Loki, and they're holding him down to the floor. Har, feel our icy grip, Laufey, son, and know that this is only the beginning. No longer shall your frozen hands work their deadly spells.
And when the cold hidden in your castle is ours, we shall freeze the blood within your veins.
Then shall Loki, tiny whelp of Jotunheim, truly become a frost giant in all but stature.
And Thor realizes that he needs to help Loki here. It's like, woe to Thor, that he should have witnessed such a sight. Loki's bravery before impossible odds reveals Thor's shame and the fullness of its disgrace. Woe that the God of Thunder should have ever thought to flee such foes as Grendel and the Absorbing Man. Mayhap Loki does not bear the curse of Hela. Tis no matter. Loki is the son of giants. Thor is the son of gods. And we then shift scenes to the throne room of Baldur. And Baldur is there with his vizier, is Ularic the Warlock. Remember him? We saw him once in an old story a long time ago. Baldur's like, "And you think, Ularic, that the stars foretell great danger for the realm?"
"Never more dangerous than now, Baldur. I cannot say what form the peril will take, but be assured, there's very..."
And Ularic starts to fall down, he's getting dizzy, can't stand. So he's got the sickness that a lot of the other gods have had. And Baldur's like, "Ularic, what ails thee? Revered one, let Baldur's strength become thine own. Guard, guard!" And Heimdall comes in with the enchantress in his arms, and Heimdall's like, "Save thy breath, Baldur. The guard can no more hear you than can the enchantress. Heimdall, what transpires? Has some hidden enemy breached the defenses of the realm?"
"I cannot say, Baldur. The enchantress has become as hard as stone, and even now she may no longer live. And I too have caught whatever deadly thing this is, and feel my limbs failing."
And Baldur's starting to panic. "Heimdall, Heimdall, surely this cannot be the end. Not like this. Shall Asgard perish without a single defender rising on her behalf? Shall all that we have done come crumble into the dust, and yet no measure of the enemy taken? Only the son of Odin might help us now. But where is Asgard's mightiest warrior in her desperate hour of need? My limbs do stiffen also, and the room swirls before me. Thor, where are you? Thor!" And all goes quiet. We then shift back to Loki's castle, and they're still holding Loki down. And Loki apparently is unconscious, and the giants are,
"Well, we'll wake him up soon enough when we have the secret of his cold."
And all of a sudden, the walls start to collapse and start to bury the giants, and they go, "No, Grog!" And it's Thor, and he's knocked down the wall on top of all the giants, and he goes in and grabs Loki out as the giants are running away. Though I can't imagine why they're running away at this point, because they really kind of seem to have won anyway. But I guess the wall falling is enough to get them scared, and so they run. Thor grabs Loki out and gets his hammer back. He notes that one of the giants' bodies helped to protect Loki from the falling debris. And Thor's like, "Come, trickster. Though you and I have ever fought and hated in the past, you shall not die alone unmourned this day. I can barely stand upright without fainting, but I shall stay the course, Loki. Who would have thought that after all these centuries, the fosterling of giants should have taught the gods a lesson in courage?" I guess he doesn't realize that Loki's the one who is responsible for bringing the giants here to begin with. "And though well I know that it was you that brought me hence, 'twas for no good purpose. Still you have saved me from the hands of the dark elves. Mayhap this time we shall settle all scores between us ere this day is done." And Thor is noting that it's really, really cold here. "My breath congeals almost before it leaves my lungs. Whatever secret Loki hath wrested from the glaciers, surely it lies within this chamber." And he just opens the door and walks in. Now, I thought the door had been smashed down by the giants. So why is he opening this new door? So I guess he's taking the back door into the laboratory. And Iceman is there, and he's no longer iced up at this point. He recognizes Thor.
"Who? Thor, is it really you?"
"Loki's secret is human. Wearing a variation of the costume I saw beneath New York City only days ago."
And he's talking, of course, about the Morlock saga, where Thor basically discovered all the dead Morlocks and he fought the Marauders and all that stuff. That was back in Thor number 373 and 374, which at this point was about 5 issues ago. And so Thor basically grabs a hold of Iceman, and Iceman introduces himself as Bobby Drake, part of X-Factor, and we know that because we saw him last issue, and also Walt Simonson was writing X-Factor during this time period. He tells Thor that he's heard what he did for the Angel down in the tunnels. Basically, Thor saved the Angel's life, and asks Thor if he has a habit of saving them. And Thor's like, "I fear not, Bobby. This time I doubt if I could even save myself. How came you here?"
"Loki told me, bragged about it. Said he had some kind of device that created spheres of energy that could transport stuff instantaneously. Brought me here, rigged me up to freeze, but I froze all right. Everything. I've never been able to generate such cold in my life. I don't think he liked it."
And Iceman falls unconscious,
And the door is being beaten on, apparently by the giants, with a broom, broom. And Thor realizes the door's not going to hold very long. Is talking to Loki. A pity, Loki, that you are not awake to greet your guests. No matter. The boy has told me enough. I recognize from his description the great machine that once brought the absorbing man to Earth so long ago. Now, I didn't make this connection before, but that is interesting that this is the same device that Loki used to bring the absorbing man to Asgard. And that was a long time ago. In fact, we've already covered that back during the Lee Kirby era. And Thor says, I see it here. Thor has not forgotten that were it not for you, there should have been no victory over Surtur in the final encounter. And today, win or lose, that debt shall be paid. You have taught the Thunder God a lesson in courage. Mayhap he can teach you one of honor. And then Thor gets the gun, the sort of the ray gun that brought Iceman here. And he is pointing it towards Pittsburgh and the Damascus steel mill. And he says, the magic of the device even pierces the veil of storms that lies between here and Midgard, annihilating the distance until I can locate exactly what I wish to find. And we cut to Earth and the steel mill. And the steel workers are all gathered around, and they basically have all the armor that Thor has not finished. But it's all laying around in a pile here. And they go like, those weirdies sure vanished in a hurry. Even took that big guy with them. Maybe we ought to move it.
Not me, mister. Thor rented the mill for an entire week. And until that week is up, I ain't touching a thing.
And so there's this pile of armor on the floor. And Thor's looking for it, I guess, through this gun thing. And he's like, no, I'm gone. Their awe has kept the mortals from disturbing the armor. The fates be thanked for that. There's a reporter there, and he's like, what's really going on? Our readers are going to want to know something about these spooks. And Thor's like, alas, sirrah, I think that even as you, your readers may be forced to wonder about the true nature of the battle forever, and of the armor forged of Asgardian steel. And it starts to glow, and they're like, look out, it's glowing, get back.
The stuff's disappearing. I'll bet it's Thor. He's collecting his things.
So after he presses the trigger, and I guess the armor is going to be transported here to Loki's castle, Thor decides he needs to start a fire. He says the armor will arrive any moment, and I must be ready. Only fires wrought by my enchanted hammer Mjolnir can create the heat necessary to emblazon the sacred runes of Odin upon the metal, and thereby finish the task I began on Earth. And he's whirling his hammer around, and Thor's saying, my limbs ache with the effort, but the heat is still insufficient. Faster still must I whirl Mjolnir, till my very bones do grind in their sockets. And he's being surrounded by this golden globe, he calls it, so I guess he's trying to win an award here. And now as the golden globe encases me, as the armor materializes around me, let the lightning scribe the ancient symbols of power upon the hauberk. Strike now! And with a cratharoom, we shift scenes. And where do we find ourselves? But in the forest, where Fandral, Hogun, and Sif, along with the twin human children and Volstagg's daughter Hildi, are making their way towards Asgard. And they're none of them are feeling well, except for the two human boys. Apparently they're immune from this whatever it is, this illness. And Hogan's saying, I too feel the fever. We must reach Volstagg's hall. Okay, they're heading towards Volstagg's house.
I do not think I can stand much longer, says Sif.
Me neither, says Hildi. I feel awful.
And Sif collapses, and Hogan's like, Sif! And he's like, unconscious, and already her limbs are as frigid as the mountains of Jotunheim. And the boys are really scared, and they're like, Hildi! Wah! And she's like, I can't lift my feet anymore. And Hogan's like, be strong, little warriors. Help her. Her father's hall is near. And Hogan has got Sif in his arms, and he's thinking to himself, my arms seem to carry the weight of a carven statue, not the lithesome goddess at all. What dread misadventure has come upon us? And the two boys are trying to guide Hildi, and he's like,
come on, Hildi, it isn't much further now. You can do it. Just lean on us.
And they approach the house, And Hogan's like, the great hall is silent. Where are the sounds of eternal play that should surround the enormous one's dwelling? And they go inside the house, and the kids are like, oh, no. And everyone in the house basically is collapsed, except for Volstagg, who's kind of standing next to his wife, who is sitting in a chair. And just as they enter, he falls over with a giant garoom, and everyone else collapses as well, except for Kevin and Mick. And they are the only ones left standing. Well, there's Hildy standing, but only because she's being held up by them. And we then shift back to the castle of Loki as the giants finally burst their way into Loki's laboratory with a batrathum. And they break in and they see Loki and Iceman are just kind of laying there unconscious on the floor. Loki's costume seems to have changed, incidentally. Not quite sure how that happened, because it looks way different from the costume that he was wearing back in the beginning of the issue. And I really doubt that he changed his costume while he was unconscious. And the giants are like, here lies Loki, but how came he here beneath the fallen wall? And though the room fairly vibrates with cold, where are his secret magics? Where is the source of the cold? And one of the other giants is like, Grandroth, feel! And they hear can feel the cold coming from Iceman as he's laying there unconscious. The youth, cold radiates from him unceasingly, enough to sting even my fingers. Which is interesting because he's not iced up. He's not using his mutant power, so I don't know what's going on here. And by the look of him, a mortal. And they hear a voice.
So he is. And that places him under my protection, Grundroth. Who? In yon corner, a blinding light, and some dim figure. Step out from where we can see you, faceless one.
Thor steps out, and he is dressed in this new armor, like we saw on the cover. And like I said, I've already kind of described it. He's got banded mail on his arms and legs. And he's still wearing the exoskeleton arm that Tony Stark made for him. And he's got, it's kind of yellow armor. He's got this, vambrace that's, silver. And a gold helmet with the sort of mask thing on it. And kind of a chainmail, mullet thing down beside his head. And he's got this blue hauberk. It looks like it's made of scale mail. And there's, clasps that are holding his cape on. And basically, yeah, it's pretty cool. And Thor's like, step back, creatures of evil, or face my wrath.
Who dares speak thusly to the giants of Jotunheim?
We were sired by Ymir, oldest of all. None who lives may give us orders. My sire was the ruler of the gods, rash Thurs.
Apparently Thurs is a Norse word for giant.
Odin was my father, and the thunder and lightning are my birthright. They speak my name in whispers in the nurseries of thine icy home. And he hurls Mjolnir at one of the giants and smacks one of them in the head with a giant krang.
And the giant falls down. And the Grundroth is like, Thor!
Aye, Thor, villains. And before I'm finished, every last one of you will regret your wrath incursion into Asgard.
And he's smashing them around with his hammer. And they're smashing him back.
They're like, Loki has revealed to us the secret of his vulnerability. Hela hath cursed him with brittle bone.
And they smack him back against the wall. And Thor's like, Arg!
Our blows will shatter his body through the armor till there's nothing left to hold him up.
Tiny worm, you'll never rise again. Kartak sees to that.
And Kartak is trying to smash Thor with a big stone axe, but Thor stops it with Mjolnir and manages to hold the axe up and manages to keep it from crushing him.
Too slow, thou grotesque. I am no longer the invalid you hope to find, nor do I wear ordinary armor. Forged in the furnaces of Pittsburgh, graven with the runes of my father, this armor has become my body. And the frail flesh and bones within command it, even as they once commanded the body that was whole. Now let us end the charade. As you destroyed Loki's footing, so shall I destroy yours. And he smashes out the floor from underneath them.
Basically doing the old Hulk trick, smashing the ground and creating shockwaves. And is tossing the giants all around. And they're
watch out, shockwaves.
But the Thunder God is far more agile than any giant. And every broken cobble becomes a deadly weapon when wielded by a master's hand.
And he's batting the stones at them with Mjolnir like a baseball bat. And it's hitting all the giants, and they're getting hit in the head. And they're like, get out, you fools! We're no match for him now!
What about the others?
What about them?
They're dead already. We can do them no good. But we'll have our vengeance, never fear.
And the giants go running away. And Thor comes crawling out of the wreckage of Loki's castle. And he's saying, "My foes have fled the field of battle. Thor is victorious as ever. Such is thy lesson, brother. See how easily honor follows victory? Then why do I taste the wormwood of despair? Armor is no substitute for a fighting heart, and Thor's heart misgives him that before all is said and done, it will not be Thor's armor that shall be tested by fate, but his very heart and soul." And we shift scenes to outside of Loki's castle, and the giants have fled, and it's still snowing like crazy out here. The giants are kind of gathering around, and they're making plans, and
like, "It's no good! Thor has beaten us again! The armor seems to have restored his fighting spirit, made him worse than ever. There isn't a giant living who can withstand him now. What can we do? It's hopeless."
And Grunthrok says, "Never. I swear I shall never rest until Thor's bones are ground to dust."
"But you said no giant."
"I'm not thinking of a giant, but rather of the offspring of one. Loki's child, Jormungand."
"The Midgard serpent? It's too dangerous! The serpent's mad!"
"Shut up! No one mocks the sons of Ymir. In the end, the Nine Worlds will be ours to plunder, and Thor's bones will be dust."
And that is Thor number 378. All right, so just a few words about this story as we go through these last few issues of Simonson's run. I think the story is a very well-told story. Simonson is a good storyteller, and that should be obvious, for at least from the early days of his run on Thor. Some of this later stuff has not been as good, in my opinion. But at the same time, we are seeing things now kind of gearing up. We know that his run is going to be ending now in like 4 or 5 issues. So we're getting ready for the big wind-up. All of this is building to a climax. And so I think the story is being told well. We are kind of still in the middle of it, so yeah, we'll see which direction it goes as we go through the stories. I don't want to ruin anything for you guys. Yeah, I know. It's kind of silly to worry about spoilers when you're dealing with a comic book from 1987. A lot of people haven't read it, including I haven't read these things for a long time. And some of these I haven't read at all, so it does add a little bit of, I don't know what's going to happen next either, because I'm not reading a lot of issues ahead. But anyway, artwork by Sal Buscema, yeah, so, and it's, you know how I think about Sal Buscema. I'm not going to go and belabor the point. I do think that he's a better inker than he is a penciler, and I do see some evidence over these last few issues that he's taking more time on his inks, and the artwork is looking progressively better as we go. It's still very much in that Sal Buscema style that I don't like, but I honestly think that he's probably a better inker than he is a penciler. And that's true of a lot of people, but I think maybe especially of him. So by and large, I think the characters look pretty much the way they're supposed to look. I like the design of the new armor. You can tell it was designed by Simonson and not by Buscema. And so it doesn't look quite right when Buscema draws it, kind of like Heimdall's armor, which was designed by Simonson as well. I think it would be very fair to say that it's difficult for other artists to duplicate Walt Simonson's take on a costume. And when you have, for example, the armor that Baldur wears in the Baldur the Brave miniseries, it really didn't look the same unless Simonson was drawing it. And I think that this kind of goes for, characters like Malekith and Curse and to a very large extent, things like Beta Ray Bill. It just doesn't look the same when people other than Walt Simonson draw these things. But most artists can give it a college try, and some can even make it look really good. And then again, you have examples like Steve Ditko trying to draw Beta Ray Bill in the issue of ROM that we covered about a year ago now, it seems like, and have it truly, truly be awful. I'm a little bit annoyed once again by the inclusion of Iceman. We talked a little bit about that last time, and it's just because Simonson, who was writing X-Factor at the same time, figures he's okay to use the characters. I don't like, still, the idea of Iceman being the one who generates the cold. And we did, like I said, we talked about that last time, and I'm really not going to talk about it again this week. All right, so that is it for this episode. Hope you enjoyed our myth and also Thor number 378. And we will be back next week continuing on Simonson's run as we work our way up to Thor number 382 and the climax of Simonson's run. So if you want to email the show, please feel free to do so. The email address is RadioFreeAsgard@gmail.com. You can also contact us on Facebook in the Radio Free Asgard Facebook group. Lots of links and pictures and stuff being posted lately by Manuel. So thanks very much, Manuel. And of course, I do read that page every single day and try to participate in all of the discussions as well. All right. So without any further ado, it's time to go. Thanks very much for listening. And we'll see you next week here on Radio Free Asgard.